Hold you together for a special purpose. To begin with, I want to make a special plea to Mademoiselle.
To me?
Mademoiselle, you are engaged to Captain Ralph Berton. If anyone is in his confidence, you are. Will you not trust me and tell me where he is hiding?
Monsieur Poirot, I swear to you that I have no idea of where Ralph is, and that I have neither seen him nor heard from him, either on the day of the murder or since.
Bien, that is that. Now, I appeal to the others who sit round this table. If you know where Ralph Berton is hiding, speak out. Understand this? I mean to arrive at the truth. I mean to know. And I shall know, in spite of you all.
How do you mean, in spite of us all?
Every one of you in this room is concealing something from me.
It
may be something unimportant, trivial, which is supposed to have no bearing on the case, but there it is. Each of you has something to hide. Come now. Am I right? I am answered. I appeal to you all. Tell me the truth. Will no one speak? C'est dommage.
I wish you'd tell me what you really think of it all.
You have seen what I have seen. Should not our ideas be the same?
I'm afraid you're laughing at me. I've no experience in matters of this kind, and I'm trying to keep a journal of the case.
Are you, Doctor? You must let me have a look at it. Very well, then. The first thing is to get a clear history of what happened that evening, always bearing in mind that the person who speaks may be lying. So, first, Dr. Shepherd leaves the house at 9:10. How do I know that?
Because I told you so.
And you might not be speaking the truth. But Parker confirms it, and we accept your statement. At 9:00... you run into a man just outside the park gates. How do I know that this is so?
I told you so.
Ah, you know that it is so. But how am I to know? So, I talk around the village, and the maid of Miss Gannett says she met your mysterious stranger inquiring for Fernley Park a few minutes before you did. And the barmaid at the Three Boars says he had a drink there, and he mentioned having just come over from the States. Did it strike you that he had an American accent?
Come to think of it, yes, he had.
So, we accept your stranger. And there is also this, which, you remember, I picked up in the summer house.
Ah, the little quill.
And you know that feathers like this are used to sniff drugs. It is a method used by drug addicts in the United States of America.
So, you're suggesting that the stranger went to the summer house to meet somebody. But who was that somebody?
Exactly the question. Now, another point. What did you think of the parlour maid story? Does it take half an hour to dismiss a servant?
You bewilder me.
And there is still the mystery of the telephone call and the pushed-out chair.
Do you really think the latter important?
Or perhaps not. I will not press the point. Tell me instead, what were Ralph Patton's reasons for disappearing?
I can only think that his nerve must have failed him.
Yes, that is true, but we must not lose sight of one thing.
I know what you're going to say. Motive. Ralph Peyton inherits a great fortune by his uncle's death.
That is one motive. But do you realize there are three separate motives staring us in the face? Somebody stole the envelope containing evidence of the blackmailer's identity. Was that why Ackroyd was killed? And was Peyton the blackmailer? And then there is the fact that he was in some scrape which he feared might reach his uncle's ears.
Put like that, the case does seem black against him.
Does it? Three motives? It is almost too much. I am inclined to believe that, after all, Ralph Berton is innocent.
After that talk with Poirot,
the affair seemed to me to enter on a different phase. Up till the Monday evening, I had played Watson to his Holmes. After then, our ways diverged, and Poirot was busy on his own account. But that challenge of his to the company round the table had its effect, as I was soon to discover. On Tuesday morning, I had a summons from Ackroyd's sister-in-law.
I thought, Doctor, that you might explain it all to Monsieur Poirot, because it's so difficult for a foreigner to see our point of view. And you don't know what I had to contend with. Every slightest bill I ran up had to be gone over with Roger, as if he had a few miserly hundreds a year, instead of being one of the wealthiest men in these parts. And then I got these letters, abusive letters, threatening letters, and so I wanted to know how I stood. I expected that Roger would provide for me in his will, but I didn't know. And then, on Friday afternoon...
Yes, on Friday afternoon.
Everyone seemed to be out, so I went into Roger's study. There was nothing underhand about it. He'd left his keys in the lock of the top drawer of his desk.
So you searched the desk. Did you find the will?
As I got to the bottom drawer, the parlourmaid Bourne came in. Of course, I shut the drawer and called her attention to a few specks of dust on the surface, but I didn't like the way she looked. I never have liked that girl very much. Too well educated, for one thing.
And what happened next?
Nothing. At least Roger came in, and I told him I'd come in to get punch. Bourne stayed behind, and I heard her asking Roger if she could speak to him for a minute. I went straight up to my room to lie down. Bourne may have made some extraordinary story out of it all. You will explain to Monsieur Poirot, won't you?
But my curiosity about the parlourmaid had been awakened. She was in the hall, and I could see that she'd been crying.
I'll get your coat, sir.
How is it that you told us that Mr. Ackroyd sent for you, when I now hear that it was you who asked to speak to him?
I meant to leave in any case. Excuse me, sir. Is there any news of Captain Peyton?
None that I know of.
He ought to come back. Does no one know where he is?
Do you?
I know nothing. But anyone who was a friend to him would tell him this. He ought to come back.
I thought I had better report all this to Poirot. But he had a new bee in his bonnet. He was obsessed by the colour of Ralph Peyton's boots. He had asked Caroline to find out for him, as the boot boy at the Three Boars had reported that they were black.
It is a great pity. Ah, well. Now, on the Friday morning before the murder, I believe that Miss Russell, the housekeeper, came to consult you. Is it indiscreet to ask what passed at the interview? Apart from the medical details, I mean.
Not at all. We talked for a few minutes about poisons and the ease or difficulty of detecting them. And about drug-taking and drug-takers.
With special reference to cocaine?
How did you know?
Oh, just a thought. Have you come to any conclusions about the case?
None at all. Except to wonder whether one of our conclusions is wrong or too hasty.
And what is that?
We've assumed that the blackmailer of Mrs. Ferrers is necessarily the murderer of Mr. Ackroyd. Mightn't we be mistaken?
Very good indeed. I wondered if that idea would come to you. But we must remember one point. The letter disappeared. Still, that may not necessarily mean that the murderer took it. When you first noticed the body, Parker may have abstracted the letter unnoticed by you.
Parker?
Yes, Parker. I wonder. It is in my mind to try a little experiment with Parker. How say you, my friend? Will you accompany me to Fernley?
I believe you wanted to see me, Monsieur Poirot.
Mademoiselle Flora, I have to confide in you a little secret. I am not yet satisfied of the innocence of Parker. I propose to make a little experiment with your assistance. I wish to reconstruct some of his actions on that night. Will you help me?
Of course, Monsieur Poirot.
Excellent. Ah, here he comes. My good Parker. Oh. You've brought the tray and the decanter as I requested? Good. Now, I wish you to aid me in a little experiment.
Oh.
I have placed a colleague on the terrace outside the study. I want to see if anyone there could have heard the voices of Miss Ackroyd and yourself.
A reconstruction of the crime, sir?
Exactly. Now then, you came from the outer hall, and where was Mademoiselle?
Here, just outside the study door.
Quite right, sir, yes.
I had just closed the door.
Yes, miss, yes. Your hand was still on the handle, as it is now.
Yeah. Then play me the comedy.
Oh, Parker, Mr. Ackroyd doesn't want to be disturbed again tonight. Is that right?
Yes, miss, yes. But I fancy you use the word evening instead of tonight. Very good, miss. Shall I lock up as usual?
Yes, please. And then I went back to my room.
Admirable. Oh, by the way, Parker, are you sure there were two glasses on your tray that evening? Who was the second one for?
I always bring two glasses, sir. Is there anything further?
No, nothing. I thank you. And thank you too, Miss Ackroyd. That was most helpful.
I'm glad you got what you wanted.
What was the point of the question about the glasses?
Oh, one must say something. That particular question did as well as any other. At any rate, I know now something I wanted to know.
Monsieur Poirot.
Mr. Raymond?
Just received a call from the police. A man has been detained at Liverpool. His name is Charles Kent, and he is believed to be the stranger who visited Furley that night. They want you and Dr. Shepherd to go to Liverpool.
Well, my dear doctor, is this the man?
The height's the same, and as far as general appearance goes, it might well be the man in question.
Look, what the hell is all this? I demand to know why I'm being detained here. What am I supposed to have done?
It is the man. I recognize the voice.
And where do you suppose you heard it before?
On Friday evening last, outside the gates of Fernley Park. You asked me the way there.
Do you admit it, Mr. Kent?
I admit nothing, and I'll say nothing until I know why you're holding me.
Have you not read the papers in the last few days?
You mean the murder, I suppose. You're surely not trying to pin that on me.
You were there that night.
And how do you know that?
By this goose quill. It is yours, I think. You dropped it in the summer house that night.
So I was there. Tell me this, though. According to the papers, the man was killed between 9:45 and 10 o'clock. Is that so?
That is so.
Then you've nothing to keep me here for. I was away from Fernley Park by 9:25. You can ask at a pub called the Dog and Whistle out on the Cranchester Road. I was there at 9:45. They'll remember me. I had a brawl with the bartender.
Inquiries will be made. If you're telling the truth, you won't have anything to complain about. What were you doing at Fernley Park anyway?
I went there to meet someone.
Who?
That's none of your business.
Your name is Charles Kent. Where were you born?
That's none of your business either, but I'm a British citizen, if that's what you want to know.
Yes, I think you are. I fancy you were born in Kent. And now, since we can do no more until the good inspector has made his inquiries, we may as well return to King's Abbot.
Well, Kent's alibi's right enough. Confirmed by the man at the bar and three other witnesses.
Are you going to release him, Inspector?
Then see what else we can do.
If I were you, I should not release him yet.
Why not? He can't have anything to do with the murder. We know Ackroyd was alive at 9:45. You admit that, don't you?
I admit nothing that is not proved.
But we've got Miss Ackroyd's evidence.
I do not always believe what a charming young lady tells me.
Parker saw her coming out of the room.
No. That is just what he did not see. That was the point of my little experiment the other day. You remember, Doctor? Parker saw her outside the door with her hand on the handle. He did not see her come out of the door.
But where else could she have been?
Perhaps on the stairs.
But those stairs lead only to Mr. Ackroyd's bedroom.
Precisely.
What would she have been doing in her uncle's bedroom? And why would she lie about it?
That is just the question we should be asking ourselves.
You mean the money? You're not suggesting it was Miss Ackroyd who took that £40.
Life was not easy for that mother and daughter. Roger Ackroyd was a peculiar man over money matters.
I don't believe it. It's not credible. There's only one thing for it. We must tackle that young lady right away.
Flora was sitting in the billiard room with Major Blunt. To my consternation, she insisted on his staying there, though she must have had some idea of what was coming.
Flora, I simply can't believe it.
Oh, no, Hector. Monsieur Poirot is right. I took that money. I am a thief. A common, vulgar little thief. I'm glad it's come out. It's been a nightmare these last few days, lying, cheating, running up bills, promising to pay.
Flora, surely you could have...
There was nothing I could have done. At any rate, I'm real now. I'm not pretending to be the kind of girl you like, you know, young and innocent and simple. I don't care if you never want to see me again. If I had thought that for one moment that speaking the truth would have made things better for Ralph...
Ralph! Always Ralph.
You don't understand. You never will. I never did see my uncle that evening after he left the dinner table. As to money, you can take what steps you please. Nothing could be worse than it is now.
So, that's that.
Inspector, Miss Aykroyd never touched that money. Roger gave it to me for a very particular purpose. She is lying to protect Ralph. I'm prepared to go into the witness box and swear that I had the money.
Major Plant, I am not in the least deceived by your little fantasy. But it is very good what you have done there.
I am not in the least concerned about your opinion of me, monsieur.
Ah, but you must listen to me. The other day I spoke of concealments. What you have been seeking to conceal from the world is your love for Mademoiselle Flora. But take my advice. Do not conceal it from her.
What do you mean by that?
You think that she loves Ralph Berton, but that is not so. She is loyal, and she is bound by honor to stick to him. But her heart was not in the idea of marriage.
Do you really think...
If you doubt me, ask her yourself. She went into the garden, I think.
I've been every kind of fool. You're a good fellow, Poirot. Thank you.
Not every kind of fool. Only a fool in love.
This alters everything. All those alibis are worthless. 9:30, that's the time we've got to hang on to now. You were quite right about not releasing that man, Kent. He could certainly have done the murder and got to the Dog and Whistle if he ran. But he couldn't have made the telephone call. Why do we always come up against that telephone call?
Why, indeed. It is curious.
I mustn't waste any more time. I must find out precisely what everyone was doing from 9:30.
The good inspector is going to have a busy time. Now, my dear doctor, there is something I want you to do. I want you to send a note to Miss Russell and make a time for her to come to your surgery.
Whatever for?
Because I want to talk to her without the whole village knowing. And if she comes to your surgery, no one will suspect, least of all the good lady herself.
So long as I am allowed to be present.
Oh, but naturally, your own surgery. And now, I have a little surprise for you. Read this.
The police have for some days been seeking for Captain Ralph Peyton, the nephew of Mr. Aykroyd of Fernley Park, whose death occurred under such tragic circumstances last Friday. Captain Peyton has been found at Liverpool, where he was on the point of embarking for America. But it's not true. He's not in Liverpool.
No, he has not been found at Liverpool. I managed to persuade the inspector to send this to the press for tomorrow's papers. I assured him that very interesting results would follow.
That beats me. What do you expect to get out of that?
Uh-huh. You should employ your little grey cells. And now, if you would be good enough to do me that little favour?
Oh, yes, the message for Miss Russell. You know, I'm very curious to know what you're up to.
Miss Russell, Charles Kent has been arrested at Liverpool.
Well, what of it?
I thought you might be interested, that is all.
Why should I be? Who is this Charles Kent?
He is a man, mademoiselle, who was seen at Fernley on the night of the murder. We want to know what he was doing there, who it was he went to meet.
He didn't kill Aykroyd. He never went near the study. He didn't do it. You must believe me.
I do believe you. But I had to make you speak.
Is what you said true?
That he is suspected of the crime? Yes. And you alone can save him by telling the truth.
He came to see me. I went out to meet him.
In the summer house.
How do you know?
It is the business of Hercule Poirot to know things. You went out to meet him at 9:10. What did you say to each other?
It's difficult, you see.
Mademoiselle, what you tell us need not go beyond these four walls. Charles Kent, is your son, is he not?
Good Lord.
But no one's ever known. It was so long ago.
In Kent.
I was not married. I got work. I managed to pay for his board and lodging. I never told him that I was his mother, but he turned out badly. He drank, and then he took to drugs. I scraped together the money for his passage to Canada. He was there for 2 years, and then somehow or other he found out that I was his mother, and he wrote asking for money. Finally, I heard from him back in this country again. He was coming to see me at Fernley.
So you arranged to see him in the summer house?
I dared not let him come up to the house. I'd brought with me all the money I had, and I gave it to him. But he was very rough and abusive.
What time did he leave?
It must have been between 20 and 29 minutes past nine. It was not yet 9:30 when I got back to the house.
Which way did he go?
By the way he came. The path to the lodge gates.
I think that is all.
The paragraph inspired by Poirot duly appeared in our daily paper the next day. I was in the dark as to its purpose, but its effect on Caroline was immense.
I knew he'd try to get away to America. That's what Crippen did.
Without much success.
Poor boy, and now they've caught him. Well, there's one person who's reacted pretty quickly.
And who is that?
Flora Ackroyd. She's engaged to Hector Blunt. But Mr. Poirot is here. He's sure to know all about it.
Good day, Doctor. I have a little commission for you, my friend.
Don't worry, I'll go.
I want to arrange a little conference this evening at my house. You will attend, will you not?
Of course.
I also need all those in the house. That is to say, Mrs. Ackroyd, Mademoiselle Flora, Major Plant, Mr. Raymond. You will ask them, yes?
With pleasure.
The parlourmaid from Fernley's here, Ursula Bourne. She's in a terrible way, poor thing. She says she must see Mr. Poirot at once.
Doctor. Monsieur Poirot.
Miss Bourne.
No. No, that is not quite right. It is not Miss Bourne, is it, my child? But Mrs. Ralph Payton.
Well, oh, there, my dear. It'll be all right. You'll see, everything will be all right.
This is very weak and silly of me.
No, my child. We can all realize the strain of this last week.
It must have been a terrible ordeal.
I saw this in the paper this morning. It says that Ralph has been arrested, so I need not pretend any longer.
All the same, I think you will do well to make a clean breast of things. So you will tell me the whole story, will you not? If I am to save your husband, I must know all there is to know.
What I want to know is why this child was masquerading as a parlour maid.
For a living. My family is Irish. Impoverished gentlefolk, I suppose you might call them. I didn't want to become a governess, so I decided I would take on a job as parlour maid. My sister wrote me a reference, and I was taken on at Fernley Hall. I enjoyed the work, and I had plenty of time to myself. I met Ralph Payton, and we fell in love. I didn't like the idea of a secret marriage, but he told me his uncle would never hear of his marrying a penniless girl. So no one knew about it.
No one?
Not a soul. Ralph had always had debts. He's not good with money, and his troubles got worse and worse. But Mr. Ackroyd refused to lift a finger to help him. And then one day, I knew nothing of this, of course. Mr. Ackroyd told Ralph that it was the desire of his heart that Ralph should marry Flora, and that if Ralph did so, he would clear his debts. And Ralph accepted. I mean, God knows how he thought he was going to get out of it all. They both stipulated that the whole thing should be kept secret, but without any warning, Mr. Ackroyd decided to announce the engagement. It was like a bombshell. I was desperate. Ralph came down from town, and we met in a wood on the estate. He still wanted me to keep our marriage secret, but I told him I was going straight to Mr. Ackroyd. We had a terrible row and parted.
You poor soul.
So I went to Mr. Ackroyd, and he was very angry and very bitter, mainly against Ralph, but also against me, because he was convinced that I had deliberately set out to trap Ralph. That evening I met Ralph again in the little summer house. He accused me of ruining his relationship with his foster father. I told him he was a coward and a cheat. And we parted. And then I heard that Mr. Ackroyd had been murdered. And since that night I have neither seen nor heard from Ralph.
Mademoiselle, what time was it when you parted from Ralph Payton in the summer house?
This is something I've gone over and over again in my mind. I reached the summer house at 10:27. Ralph was waiting for me. I was with him for a few minutes. No longer. It was 10:15 when I got back to the house.
Who left the summer house first?
I did.
Leaving Ralph Petton there?
Yes. But you don't think...
It is of no importance what I think. Where did you go?
Up to my room.
And stayed there until...
About 10:00.
Is there anyone who can prove that?
Prove that I was in my room? But surely no one...
Thinks that it was you who went up by the window and stabbed Mr. Aykroyd as he sat in his chair? Yes. They might think just that.
Oh, God!
Don't worry, my dear. Mr. Poirot doesn't think that, really. As for that husband of yours, I don't think much of him. Running away and leaving you to face the music.
This evening I shall want Madame to attend my little reunion. 9:00 at my house. It is most necessary that she should be there. Mrs. Aykroyd, Miss Flora Aykroyd, Major Blunt, Mr. Geoffrey Raymond, Mrs. Ralph Peyton, John Parker, Elizabeth Russell.
All present and correct.
Every one of you had the opportunity to kill Mr. Aykroyd.
I don't like it. I don't like it. I would much prefer to go home.
You cannot go home, madame, until you have heard what I have to say. I will start at the beginning. When Miss Aykroyd asked me to investigate the case, I went to Fernley Park with Dr. Shepherd. My eye was caught by a little summer house, and I searched it carefully. There I found two things, a scrap of starched cambric and an empty goose quill. The scrap of cambric immediately suggested a maid's apron, and I noticed from Inspector Raglan's list that one of the maids, Ursula Bourne, had no real alibi. The quill suggested a taker of drugs, and Dr. Shepherd had encountered a stranger with an American accent. Was this the man who Ursula Bourne had met in the summer house? But then, I began to suspect that there had been two meetings in the summer house that night, and I discovered that Dr. Shepherd's mysterious stranger had in fact come to Fernley to meet Miss Russell, the housekeeper. Mm-hmm. Who then did Ursula Bourne come to meet? I found this ring, a wedding ring with "From R" engraved inside it. So, it was Ralph Peyton to whom she was secretly married. And this revealed another unexpected point. It could not have been Ralph Peyton who was with Mr. Aykroyd in the study at 9:30. So, we come now to the most interesting part of the crime. Who was in the room with Mr. Aykroyd at 9:30? And then I posed my cleverest, my most audacious question. Was anyone with him?
But I distinctly heard his voice. So did Major Blunt.
Just a moment. From the beginning of the case, I have been struck by one thing. The nature of the words which you overheard, Mr. Raymond. It has been amazing to me that no one has seen anything odd about them. The calls on my purse have been so frequent of late that I fear it is impossible for me to accede to your request. Now, would any man use such a phrase in talking to another? Now, if he had been dictating a letter...
You mean he was reading a letter aloud? Even so, he must have been reading to someone.
Ah, you are forgetting one thing. The stranger who called at the house the preceding Wednesday.
The man from the dictaphone company.
A dictaphone? Is that what you think?
I inquired of the company. Mr. Aykroyd did purchase a dictaphone. Why he concealed the matter from you, I do not know.
But surely this still leaves the basic position unchanged. Mr. Aykroyd was alive at 9:30, since he was speaking into the dictaphone. It seems clear that this Charles Kent person was, in fact, off the premises by then. As to Ralph Peyton, if only he would come forward.
That is your advice, yes? That he should come forward?
Certainly.
If you know where he is.
I do know where he is. He is there, in the doorway.
Oh, Ralph!
Do you remember when I accused you all of concealing something from me? Four of you gave up your secrets. But Dr. Shepherd did not give up his. He met Ralph Payton on the way home from the scene of the crime.
I did. I told him that suspicion was bound to fall on him, or if not on him, on the girl he loved.
I realized that the only thing I could do was to go into hiding. And Dr. Shepherd said he thought he could find somewhere for me.
And so he did. It took me some time to work out where. A hotel? No. Lodgings? Even more emphatically, no. And then I saw a home for the mentally unfit. I invent a nephew with mental trouble. I consult Mademoiselle Shepherd as to suitable homes. And in a very little time, I find Captain Payton.
Dr. Shepherd has been very loyal, but I now see that I should have come forward and faced the music. But you see, in that home, I knew nothing of what was going on.
What did happen that night?
You know it already. I left the summer house at about 9:45 and tramped about the lanes trying to make up my mind as to what to do next. I'm bound to admit that I've not the shadow of an alibi, but I swear to you I never went into that study.
No alibi. I believe you, of course, but it's a bad business.
It makes things very simple, though. Very simple indeed.
What do you mean?
Just this. To save Captain Payton, the real criminal must confess. I did not invite Inspector Raglan tonight for a very special reason. I did not want to tell him all that I knew. At least I did not want to tell him tonight. I know the murderer is in this room now. It is to the murderer I speak. Tomorrow, the truth goes to Inspector Raglan. You understand? Monsieur et Madame, this reunion of mine is at an end. Stay a moment, Doctor. I would like to talk to you.
Certainly.
Well, my friend, and what do you think of it all?
I don't know what to think. Why not go straight to Inspector Raglan with the truth, instead of giving the murderer a chance to escape?
The murderer cannot escape. There is only one way out, and that way does not lead to freedom.
You really believe that one of those people here tonight committed the murder?
Yes, my friend.
Which one?
Let me share my thoughts with you, Doctor. I will take you the way that I have travelled myself, and you will see that all the facts lead indisputably to one person. Let us start with the telephone call. I satisfied myself that the call could not have been sent by anyone in the house, and therefore I concluded that it must have been sent by an accomplice. I was not pleased by that deduction, but let it stand for the minute. I next examined the motive for the call. Its only result was that the murder was discovered that night instead of the following morning. You agree with that?
Yes. Mr. Ackroyd had given orders that he was not to be disturbed, so nobody would have been likely to go into the study.
But what was the advantage of that? The only idea I could get hold of was that the murderer, knowing that the crime had to be discovered at a certain time, could make sure of being present when the door was broken in. And now we come to the second fact. The chair pulled out from the wall.
Inspector Raglan didn't seem to place much importance on that.
Picture the scene for yourself. The chair stood in a direct line between the door and the window.
The window?
But I soon abandoned that supposition because the chair concealed very little.
But what it did conceal was a little table with magazines on it. Supposing that there had been something on that table not intended to be seen. Something placed there by the murderer.
But what could that have been?
Now, we know that a dictaphone was supplied to Mr. Aykroyd. Why was no dictaphone found?
I never thought of that.
So, it was the dictaphone. But a dictaphone cannot be slipped casually into the pocket. There must have been a receptacle capable of holding it. So, the figure of the murderer is taking shape. A person who was on the scene of the crime straight away, but who might not have been if the crime had been discovered the following morning. A person carrying a receptacle into which the dictaphone might be fitted.
But why remove the dictaphone? What was the point?
Ah, you are like Mr. Raymond. You take it for granted that what was heard at 9:30 was Mr. Aykroyd speaking into a dictaphone. But consider a minute. You dictate into it, and at some later time, a typist turns it on, and the voice speaks again.
You mean?
Yes. At 9:30, Mr. Aykroyd was already dead. It was the dictaphone speaking, not the man.
And the murderer switched it on.
Or had attached to it some mechanical device to set it off at a particular time. Now we come to the footprints on the window ledge. Two conclusions were open to me. They might really have been made by Ralph Peyton, or they were made by somebody deliberately trying to throw suspicion onto him. Now, one pair of Peyton's shoes had been obtained from the Three Boars by the police, and I found out that he had two pairs. If my theory was correct, the murderer must have been wearing the other pair. But if that was so, then Peyton must have had some other kind of footwear. That was why I asked your sister to find out about Peyton's boots.
But it was the colour.
No. That was to obscure my reason for asking. And the first question I asked Peyton when I found him was what he was wearing on his feet that night. And he replied at once that he had worn boots. Now, there is one further point. The murderer must have had the opportunity to take the dagger from the silver table.
But anyone might have done so.
Oh, yeah, possibly. But let us look at the figure we are building up. A person who was at the Three Boars earlier that day, who could have taken Peyton's shoes. A person who knew Aykroyd well enough to know about the dictaphone. A person who had the opportunity to take the dagger. A person who had the study to himself for a few minutes after the crime was discovered, and who had with him a receptacle for hiding the dictaphone, such as a black bag. In fact, yourself, my dear doctor.
You're mad.
No, I am not mad.
What on earth had I to gain by murdering Aykroyd?
Safety. It was you who blackmailed Mrs. Ferrars. Who could have had a better knowledge of what killed her husband than the doctor attending him? When you spoke to me that first day in the garden, you mentioned a legacy. But that was your way of accounting for the £20,000 you exacted from Mrs. Ferrars. You lost most of it in speculation. And then you put the screw on too hard, and Mrs. Ferrars took a way out that you had not expected. If Mr. Aykroyd had learned the truth, he would have had no mercy on you. You were ruined forever.
And the telephone call? You can explain that, I suppose.
I will confess to you that it was actually my greatest stumbling block when I found that a call had actually been put through to you from King's Abbot Station. And then, when I came to see your sister that morning you were over at Marby, I inquired what patients you had had on that fatal Friday. Among your patients that morning was the steward of an American liner, the Orion. Who more suitable than he to be leaving for Liverpool that evening? But on what pretext did you get him to phone through to you from King's Abbot Station? I sent a wireless message to the steward of the Orion asking him a certain question. This is his reply. Dr. Shepherd asked me to leave a note at a patient's house. I was to ring him up from the station with the reply. The reply was no answer. It was a clever idea. The call was genuine. Your sister saw you take it. But there was only one man's word as to what was actually said. Your own.
And so what happens now?
Remember what I said. The truth goes to Inspector Raglan in the morning. But for the sake of your good sister, I am willing to give you the chance of another way out. There might be, for instance, an overdose of a sleeping draught. You comprehend me? Captain Ralph Petton must be cleared. I suggest you finish that journal of yours.
A strange end to my story. I meant it to be published as the history of one of Poirot's failures. Odd how things pan out. My greatest fear all through has been Caroline. I fancied she might guess. Well, she will never know the truth. There is, as Poirot said, one way out. What shall it be? Véronaud? It would be a kind of poetic justice. Not that I take any responsibility for Mrs. Ferrer's death. It was the direct consequence of her own actions. I feel no pity for her. I have no pity for myself either. But I wish Hercule Poirot had never retired from work and come here to grow vegetable marrows.
In The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie, dramatized for radio by Michael Bakewell, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat, and Dr. Shepherd by John Woodvine. Roger Ackroyd, Lawrence Payne, Raymond, Peter Gilmore, Caroline, Diana Olson, Miss Russell, Eva Stewart, Flora, Zela Clark, Mrs. Cecil Ackroyd, Joan Matheson, Ursula Bourne, Karen Archer, Hector Blunt, David Goodland, Inspector Raglan, Richard Tate, Inspector Davis, Simon Cuff, Ralph Payton, Paul Sir, Kent, Peter Craze, Hammond, Alan Dudley, and Parker the Butler was played by Derek Giler. The play was directed by Enid Williams.